Welcome to Mine Minds, My Voice, stories of people from around the world. See yourself in our stories.
We acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, the traditional custodians on the land on which we meet, and pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. We extend this respect to the First Nations people around the world.
Hello and welcome back to My Mind, My Voice. This is Roberta and we're here today with Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hello, I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. Your story was great. It was an amazing story and it's actually showed me this real journey of hope. But do you want to talk to me a little bit about that journey, that sort of coming to a realisation that there was hope at the end?
Yeah, I think everyone's journey is probably a little bit more complex than you can get in a 15-minute story. And there's always been little sparks of hope throughout the entire journey. One thing that I've learned in the last few years, though, is that hope is something that you can look for. I think I was really lucky as a child. There were lots of reasons to have hope. As I became a young adult, there were definitely times when hope felt like it disappeared. But what I've learned is that in those times when hope disappears, it's not all out of your control. You can go and find hope. And I find hope by going and talking to my friends and seeing the hope that they've got and, you know, hoping that some of that will rub off on me. Or sometimes just going for a walk through nature and just seeing the sunset. Or one of my favorites is going up somewhere high and seeing the shadows of the clouds on the hills. And that just fills me with a bit of hope. Creating music, particularly with friends, asking some friends over for a jam session, and there's hope there. Or even with craft. I'm really bad at craft, but I can make something. And that process of creating something, particularly a really physical endeavor, can also be a place where I find hope. So I think looking for hope is something that I've really learned about and something I've come to really treasure.
That's a really beautiful way of actually explaining hope. And I think, you know, often we think hope will just come or be given to us rather than, as you said, it's there and you've got control of it. You do have ownership over your own hope. And also that it is, in a way, a bit contagious as well, that when you're around hopeful people, that that's transferred onto you. And I suppose you talk about your Christian community, your faith community a lot, and I know that you've been in and out of a variety of different communities, and I imagine that that also creates a lot of hope for you, that community. But I just wanted to sort of look at your Christian community, your faith community, and your transition, identifying yourself as queer. And I know that you moved out of your community because of that, and you've now found another faith community that has accepted that side of you. How did that, or did that affect your mental health in any way?
Yeah, that had a huge effect on my mental health, like throughout the whole journey. Because when we're talking about faith, we're talking about sort of the core beliefs that form how you understand the world and how you make your decisions. And I went from, when I was younger, a very simplistic black and white understanding of the world and of my faith. I guess it's something that they teach when you're younger because it's simpler. Some traditions keep that sort of very strong idea of right and wrong embedded in them. But what I've come to understand from my own perspective and in my own life is that things are so much more grey than that. There's wonderful, rich complexity in life and in people. And I no longer think of the world as black and white, right and wrong, but instead seeing that gradient or that gray space where we explore and we can be kind and we can love each other. So I've been really, really fortunate now to find a faith community, a church that also embraces those ideas and finds that strength, that unity in their diversity. Interestingly, my mental health through this time, if you had asked me back when my faith was very black and white, how that impacted my mental health, I would have told you that that was amazing for my mental health. I would have told you that knowing what was, you know, what was right and what was wrong was comforting. And there is some comfort in that simplicity. And when I stepped out into the grayness, and that complexity, it was terrifying, because all these rules and these ways of understanding life that I'd had before were all just being dismantled. It was so scary, because I also knew that I was doing something that would mean that people that I really respected and really cared about would not accept, or that they'd be disappointed that I was exploring this. So that was a particularly tricky place, because it felt like I was terrified in myself, but also I couldn't reach out to the people that I trusted and cared about for help. But as I've settled into and accepted that, you know, this world is wonderfully rich and complex, I've been able to accept myself a lot more. I've been able to accept others without judgment, and that has made a huge difference to my outlook in life and also to my just general mental health.
And I think that's really true. I think often people learn about faith, whatever it may be, whichever religious group they may belong to, as very much black and white, but it's that grey that actually gives you that comfort. And that's what faith should really all be about. It's to be in that space and find that comfort and that belief. And I think people use it in very different ways, but the richness is in the grey. And it's really sad that often, as young people, we're not taught the grey part, we're only taught the black and white, which actually makes us turn away from faith rather than actually use it as a really good tool. In your story, you belong to various different groups, and you actually belong to subgroups within groups. So you belong to a Christian group, you belong to a queer community, you belong to the culturally and linguistically diverse community, and within that culturally and linguistically diverse community, you belong to an Asian community that you were never really part of because you were born not in an Asian country. So you have this variety of boxes that you could be placed in and that society likes placing us in. Do you ever find yourself questioning which is your community? And second, being put into all those different communities, has that affected you or your mental health in any way?
Yeah, so I've always valued being able to move between communities. I remember when I first moved to Australia and I moved to university, so I lived on campus in a residential hall. And at lunchtime, I'd come down and people would sit in sort of friend groups at different tables. And I'd be able to pick, do I sit at this table with, you know, all the sporty Australian kids because, you know, I really love playing soccer and I fit in there as well. Or do I sit with all the Malaysian and Singaporean international students because there are bits of their culture that I could also connect with. And being able to move between these different communities has actually been something that I've really found rich and beneficial to my life. There is a loneliness to it as well, sometimes, where you don't always quite feel like you fit wholly in one community. And sometimes when communities, whether within themselves or with external things, hit the different communities against each other, that can be really challenging. It tends to sort of polarize conversation, and suddenly you feel like you go into a space that had felt very safe, and you've either got to keep part of yourself quiet or you've got to stand up for a group that only you represent. And that can be really challenging to your mental health. I always feel the tension between trying to look after my own mental health by pulling back from that and not putting myself in those situations which are exhausting and emotionally very taxing, but also wanting to be able to represent myself and wanting to be able to, I guess, share empathy and share stories and help people understand that we don't live in little silos of culture, but people are intersecting identities and intersecting cultures. And knowing that I could be speaking out and making that difference in that space, and also creating a space for other people to be able to speak up because they know they're not the only ones. There's a concept that I talk about in my story about castles, right? And for me, that's one that I developed as I realized that I could create a little safe community for myself of people who actually just really understood me, and we'd taken the time to understand each other's stories and where we came from and how the journey of life has progressed for each other. And those are people who are really safe and supportive of me. And then from that place of safety, I can go out into the world where it's a little bit more difficult or a little bit more challenging to speak, and then come back to your castle, to that place of safety. You know, sometimes I spend a lot of time in my castle, because that's what my mental health needs. And sometimes I can spend much more time out, and that's a decision I'm constantly making for my mental health.
That's a really cool analogy. And I think if I think of your castle, then I'd like to ask, in that castle, is it made up of all the different boxes, or do you find yourself having a main group?
Who sit at similar intersections. So, for example, queer Christians, there's a few of us, but there's also people who sit more in one space than another, but they're the people who can take the time to understand and empathize with difference, and they have taken the time to understand and empathize with my difference, and I try to do the same back to them, and we can cross that, the fact that we have different experiences. But I wouldn't actually say that we particularly draw from one. A lot of us are the ragtags who just fall in between the cracks. The main similarity we have is that we fall between the cracks of different communities. We're the ones who often live at the intersections because we share that experience. And it might not be the same communities, but we share that experience and we can understand that for each other.
That's amazing. That's actually really lovely. I want to talk a little bit about bipolar, because on our show, we haven't really talked about the experience of living with bipolar. We've talked about the experience of caring for someone with bipolar. So I'd like to ask you a little bit about that, and again, how that sort of affected, because you were already on a mental health journey before you were diagnosed. But also what I'd like to ask is what you think was the one thing that actually triggered that diagnosis.
As a bit of an explanation of bipolar disorder, it's a combination of nature and nurture factors. With your genetics, you're born with a predisposition towards bipolar disorder. That doesn't mean that you will develop it. It just means that that opportunity is kind of more there for you. And it's a matter of life experiences that mean that you might end up developing it. For me, my first sort of significant bipolar episode, and the one that I was really lucky, I got diagnosed with that first significant one. A lot of people take many, many more years. But my first sort of experience came from being in that really isolated place. And in my story, I talk about not realizing how vulnerable I was, because there was so much excitement about moving to a new country and making new friends and all of that happening at the same time, that I didn't realize that that isolation from my previous support structures back home, added with the pressure that I put on myself to perform and be a respected and valued member in the new community I found, that was, you know, really different from what I'd had before. That sort of, you know, built up over time. But one of the other things about bipolar disorder, it's very tied into your circadian rhythms. So your sleep schedule, your eating, all that sort of really physical aspect of looking after yourself. And the thing that actually set off my first manic episode, which is an episode where we talk about it as the up. The thing that actually set that off is I went to the UK and then I came back. And that shift in time zone, I came back and didn't sleep for like a week and a half. Right. Or I did sleep a little bit. I'd sleep like 2 or 3 hours a night. And I got really excited about this because I'd never have to sleep more than 2 or 3 hours a night anymore. So I could do so much more in my day. So I started making these plans on like these big Excel spreadsheets, where I had these plans of how I was going to like fit all my uni study in, and I was going to do all these other jobs, and I was going to also like basically change the world. And then, you know, coming down from that and having a period of quite severe mood instability. I described it at that point as fast and slow. I didn't have words for it, but for me it was, my thoughts were either going really fast, and I had so many thoughts, and they were amazing, right? There were great ideas that I look back at the work, it wasn't great, but there were great ideas that I could enact and everybody would love them and it would be really exciting. Or it was sort of a brain fog, like I couldn't think, I couldn't remember, I couldn't even process enough to be able to do everyday tasks. And that mood instability was the thing that I guess pushed me into feeling like self-harm was the only option. And, you know, behaviors that meant that when I started talking to other people about it, they thought, we need to get you into hospital, we need to get you into sort of medical care. And I was lucky enough to, like I said, be diagnosed quite quickly from that. I think one of my least favorite things about bipolar disorder is that you have to be really aware of when things are going really great. And it took me I'd say probably 5 or 6 or 7 years after I was first diagnosed, to not be automatically suspicious every time I felt good. Because while depression can be really challenging and it's, you know, it's not something I would wish on anybody, mania is the one where you make decisions that, you know, really make sense to you at the time, but don't actually follow any sort of line of reasoning. And there are financial ramifications, there are impacts on your friends and your relationships with your friends. And I really didn't want that to happen again. So I just spent so many years, every time I felt good, I'd go, okay, is there a reason for this good? How long has this gone for? What do I need to do to make sure that it doesn't stay? And that's a little bit sad, right? So I think being able to settle that response where I know that I'm allowed to feel good, and I do still check that there's a reason because, you know, important for me, but I'm allowed to feel good. There isn't a tiger lurking behind every good thing that I have experienced. Being allowing myself to actually experience that has been something I've had to relearn, but, you know, really rewarding as well. So.
Yeah, because it would be quite exhausting. I mean, most people generally feel good and, you know, thrive in that feeling good and just allow ourselves to take us wherever, because we're allowed to do that. But with you, it would be quite exhausting because not only are you feeling that great feeling and want to stay within that great feeling, you're also questioning that great feeling. Yeah. And it's sort of quite exhausting. But I suppose that's where your self-care stuff also became quite important for you to have that. Do you want to just talk a little bit about self-care? And I know in your story you mentioned a few things, but just in general, you know, how does your self-care look like now compared to the self-care pre-bipolar?
So one of the things about bipolar disorder is it's actually quite physical. And as a trend, this isn't the same for every single person, but bipolar depression tends to also be a little bit more physical. So there's a lot of sleep involved. You're just sleeping extra hours all the time. And there's a physical slowness, like you can notice it in speech slows down, and then the opposite happens for mania. So a lot of my self-care is really physical. So it's making sure that, you know, I've got time to go for walks in nature really make a difference for me. Being able to take time for myself, my gym sessions every week, I put them in my work calendar, and my colleagues know not to book over my gym sessions, and I really enjoy going in there and just being able to feel strong. And that's also really tied into my self-care as someone who's transgender, because it's part of how I connect with my body, but it's also how I feel more at home in my body, as I'm able to do things in the gym that help me do that. I like creating things, whether that's creating music. I actually don't listen to much music, but I like making music, because that activity, that physicality of that is really important to me. When I'm watching out for my mental health, part of it is watching out for my mood, but it's really hard to monitor your brain with your brain, and you never want to try and understand what your mood is based off just one factor or one input, right? So you can see my engineering background here. There's only one sensor here, it's not enough. So being able to watch my mood, but also notice if I'm sleeping better or sleeping worse. And for example, my wife's really keyed into that as well, and she'll say, hey, I notice you haven't been sleeping really well for the last few days. Is there something that we should be looking at? So being able to bring those friends and supports in there. Looking at the amount of activity, I can look at my calendar and see that I've been really busy for the last couple of weeks. Do I feel super, super energized about that? Or am I tired as I should expect myself to be tired? So gauging that energy level as well, and understanding my eating tends to get worse when I'm sick. So being able to notice that actually I've eaten out more than normal, or I've completely gone through all of my stocks of frozen fish and frozen everything else in the freezer because I haven't gone out and gone shopping and etc. So noticing all these different things that tell me, hey, maybe I am not feeling great and it's lasted for a couple weeks, and then I can start putting in strategies or additional strategies on top of my normal, making sure that I go for a walk, making sure that I can go to the gym, filling my life with activities that are enjoyable. So when I see that maybe my mental health is not doing quite so well, I will prioritize things like my sleeping and eating more, giving myself more time in the evenings, whether that's by saying to, you know, one of my regular commitments, hey, I'm just gonna duck out for the next couple of weeks and making sure that I have that time to say, go for a walk around the lake and doing those sorts of things that will help keep me, you know, healthy.
And that's really quite interesting because you talk about physicality and when we talk about physicality, we often think about our physical body, but then you talk about your music and I think that's the physicality of your brain working. So there's all these different levels, which is really great. But you've talked about your support system. And I suppose I want to ask you, with your mental ill health, how important has that one person been? You know, we talk a lot to young people about having the person, having your person. We don't need to know who your person is, but how important is it to have your person? Or is it important?
I think you need one person or maybe a couple of people that you know. So, okay, what I have is three people. When I am not feeling great, it is in my personal plan to go and tell at least one of these three people. Okay. They will all probably find out quite quickly because they're all very close to me. But having the three people means that I can say, all right, I'm not feeling great in this way. It means that I'm not putting so much pressure on one person. And that's really important because when I'm, one of the things that stops me from asking for help is feeling like I'm going to make somebody else's life more difficult. And I don't want to do that. But I know from experience now that if I talk to a few different people and I'm going to a few different people, that impact that I'm making because I'm not doing well is actually going to be a little bit more spread and they'll be able to more easily look after their own mental health as well. It also means that if some person is not doing great at that time, I have other people to go to. So I guess I consider myself having a small network rather than the one person because it allows me to make those choices about caring for other people while also caring for myself.
And that's great. And I suppose you look at the burden that you might put on other people, but also there's a real level of trust there. Yeah. As well. So just before we end, I just would like to ask this question, and only because, you know, research says that in the queer community there is a much higher number of people that will self-harm and suicidality is much higher. What do you think, first of all, having your mental ill health, being in the queer community, having transitioned, being from all the other communities, why do you think suicidality and self-harm is so much higher general community?
So I'll preface this with I am not an expert on the area, so yeah. This is coming just from my own perspective, but I think it's all about that sense of belonging. One thing that the queer community, no matter, you know, what color of the rainbow you are or what your background is, one thing that we often experience, especially those of us who are, I'm going to say a little bit older, I'm not that old, but like we're born into spaces where we're the only one or the only one that we know of, right? And that's really, really common growing up. I didn't know anyone else who was queer. And if there were other queer people, like it's not talked about. So unlike being born into a Chinese family and being Chinese, you don't have that support from the get-go, which means that as you get a little bit older and start realizing that you might be queer, you have to try and search for that sense of belonging somewhere. And some people are really lucky to be able to search for it at home with, you know, family who may or may not identify as part of the LGBTQIA+ family, but will understand and accept. And some people don't have that privilege. And as we grow up, and often it's late, it's in your teens or it's in your 20s or older, you're really searching for and trying to understand your own identity whilst trying to find belonging with other people. And I think that's just a lot to go through. And if you're not looking after your mental health at that point, which, you know, if you hadn't had that experience of mental illness before, you might not have that front of mind. It's really, really easy to fall into mental ill health because of that happening. And that's such a common experience across, I think, the queer community. It means that we've got much higher rates of mental illness and self-harm and suicidality and that sort of thing.
I actually think that's a really beautiful way of explaining it. I think that belonging is actually, I don't think you need to be an expert. You are an expert because you are living it. But I think that sense of belonging is really important. You know, I'm from the Italian community. I always felt like I belonged to someone because I belonged to my family. They were all Italian. Mm-hmm. If you're born with a disability, you automatically become part of that community because it's something that's accepted and it's seen. You know, the different cult backgrounds have their own clubs, have their own community halls, have their own churches and temples and stuff. So you always have that community that exists. But with that queer community, you are born into another community which might not have any other queer person. So there is that sense of not belonging from day one and trying to fit into the community that you're born into, even though it feels uncomfortable. So I actually thought that was a really beautiful way of explaining. And I really want to thank you, Sam, for today and also for sharing your story. It is a really beautiful story and it's quite different to the other stories we've heard. And it was a real privilege to listen to it. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much.
If you or yourself are dealing with a mental health concern and would like some support, please remember to call Lifeline on 13 11 14. If you are needing interpreting or translating services, please call 131 450, say your language, then say Lifeline 13 11 14, wait for a connection and you'll be connected to somebody who can support you. If it is an emergency, please remember to call 000. And once again, if you require interpreting or translating services, please just say interpreter when connecting. All of this information and more on help services and resources within the ACT can be found on MEACT's website. That's meact.org.au.